If you're a fan of literature, you might be familiar with this line from a famous poem by Robert Burns, a Scottish poet. The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. Burns, in his poem, reflects on the fact that the mice actually have it better because, though they're unaware of this, we humans are very aware of how often our plans fail. The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. On December 11th, 1998, NASA launched the Mars Climate Orbiter. This was a 745-pound space probe intended to explore the climate, atmosphere, and surface of Mars. This is the rocket, the entire equipment here, but by the time the orbiter was set free, 745 pounds. After a journey of 286 days, the spacecraft was ready for entry into the atmosphere of Mars so that it could begin to gather data. But here's the trick. This entry was going to be a group effort. There were engineers from Lockheed Martin and from NASA who were working together in order to get the orbiter into prime position for gathering data. So the engine fired, but it became clear very quickly that something was wrong. The orbiter came within about 36 miles or 60 kilometers of the planet, but this was about 100 kilometers or about 62 miles closer than had been planned. It was too close to function properly. Now, thanks to this error, the $125 million spacecraft most likely disintegrated, although there's a small chance that it spun back around Mars and is now at this point orbiting the sun somewhere in space. The cause? NASA uses the metric system. Engineers at Lockheed Martin were working with an English system of measurement. Millions of dollars gone. Millions of hours, work, calculation, preparation, gone. The best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2. Starting in verse 1. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Glancing this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known. And when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs of water to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" he asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. When we look at this text, which is a setup for God's salvation, right? This book of Exodus is this formative event in the life of Israel in the Old Testament, the definitive redemptive event when God delivers them from Egypt. But what we see when we look at Exodus 2 is a setup. It's a setup of how two people, Pharaoh and Moses, attempt to control the situation, and in that attempt to control, we see how they fall miserably short. We see that God's redemptive plan is going to unfold in God's way, in God's time, and that neither the bad guy Pharaoh nor the good guy Moses ultimately is the one who determines God's salvation plan. And so as we look at this text today, I think it's interesting, first of all, to see God's response to Pharaoh. So what you see in the first half of this chapter is that Pharaoh plans and God laughs. Now, I want to be clear, God is not specifically even mentioned in the first half of this chapter. But I think this chapter is what the psalmist was thinking of in Psalm 2 when the psalmist asked, "Why do the nations rage? Why do the kings plot and plan? The Lord who sits enthroned scoffs at them." God has a good laugh at the expense of the rulers of the earth. Because when you stop and think about it, this, I mean, the first half of this really is a comedy at Pharaoh's expense. Right? Here's Pharaoh, king of Egypt, one of the most prominent rulers in the ancient world, a ruler so powerful that he was generally considered to be a god. But God laughs. God laughs at Pharaoh's laws. At the end of chapter 1, Pharaoh gives this order. "Every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." That's Pharaoh's law. God has a sense of humor, because when you look, as Pastor Eric emphasized last week, as you look at chapters 1 and 2, who is responsible for rescuing Moses? It's actually 5 women. Pharaoh says, "Kill the boys." God says, "That's okay, I can use girls to beat Pharaoh. I can use girls to beat Pharaoh." It is Moses' sister, Moses' mom, who are determined to help Moses survive. And so Pharaoh's laws aren't really that big of a deal. And by the way, it's kind of funny how Moses' mom actually obeys this order, sort of, right? Throw the boys in the Nile. Okay, I'll throw them in there, along with this little basket with tar and pitch, so he'll kind of sail on down the Nile. So I'll follow it. I'll follow the law, just in my own kind of way. See, Pharaoh's laws can only see so far. Pharaoh's laws can only accomplish so much, because God has plans to thwart Pharaoh's laws. God also laughs at Pharaoh's authority. God also laughs at Pharaoh's authority. Pharaoh is king of this whole country. He has the power of life and death. And oh, by the way, he can't even get his daughter to do what he says. Right? Any parents have an amen in the room? Right? Pharaoh is this one who supposedly has all this power and authority. Kill the Hebrew babies. They represent this threat. And his daughter goes out and says, oh, there's a Hebrew baby. Boy, why don't I adopt him? Right? God is laughing because Pharaoh is so feeble. Not only does he not have control over the universe, not only does he not have control over the land, he can't really even control his own house. Pharaoh is being set up here to be a comic enemy, a comic weakling in the face of God's authority. God also laughs at Pharaoh's money. How does Moses get supported? Well, his mother gets paid from Pharaoh's coffers to take care of her own son. Right? This is a good deal. God is really already, what you have to see here is God is already fleecing Egypt. He's already fleecing Pharaoh. We'll see in chapter 3, God tells Moses, when he sends Moses there, guess what? You are going to leave Egypt, and not only that, when you leave Egypt, they're going to give you gold, they're going to give you treasure, and just say, just leave, just get out of here. So God, from the beginning with Moses, God is already pillaging Pharaoh's treasure. So Pharaoh's law, Pharaoh's authority, Pharaoh's money, all of these things that supposedly make him great are being mocked already. Now, I want to notice, and when we think about this, notice that before God ever intervenes, and I put that in scare quotes because obviously we recognize God is at work here, but there hasn't even been any mention of God's plan to bring Pharaoh down or what God is going to do here. But before God ever intervenes, Pharaoh's weakness is already clear. It's not just that God has to make Pharaoh look bad or make Pharaoh look silly. Human power, earthly power, already looks kind of silly. It's already weak. It can only do so much. Pharaoh's plotting, planning, his authority, his money can't get him what he wants. And so when we look at this first half of chapter 2, part of what's supposed to happen is our vision should be refocused. Our vision should be refocused. If you're trying to judge what God can do by paying attention to the pharaohs of the world, you don't understand God. Let me say that again. If you're trying to judge what God can do by paying attention to the pharaohs of the world, you don't understand God. Maybe another way to say this. If you're trying to figure out what God is doing by turning on CNN or Fox News, you're going to miss it. Because they're going to tell you about the pharaohs of the world. They're going to tell you about what people in authority in high places are doing while God is at work through these five women to bring about his redemptive plan. If you try to judge what God can do by paying attention to the favors of the world, you don't understand God. I think about this sometimes when we gather at the Grand Coney every Wednesday morning, that if I understand Scripture right, and I think I do on this point, the Spirit of God dwells in us, that we are the temple of God, that God is with us as we gather together around His Word by His Spirit, so that a group of 8 to 12 guys on Wednesday morning, this is the temple of the living God at the Grand Coney. That seems, right? I have to work hard to say that's what's happening here. Because as we're kind of rubbing the sleep from our eyes, trying to remember what we ordered, trying to get it straight, not confuse the waitress too much with our extra crispy hash browns. Where's Aaron Wetzel? Okay. It's kind of an inside joke. But as we do this, we struggle to see this. And so I want to make sure that we see God at work in the mundane, in the small task of His kingdom. That it's like a little bit of leaven that's leavening the whole bunch. But we're constantly tempted, aren't we? This is so interesting. Throughout the rest of the Old Testament, Israel is going to be constantly tempted to go back to Egypt, to go back to Pharaoh, to say our security, our strength, our survival depends on this guy, on Pharaoh, on Pharaoh's weapons, on Pharaoh's treaties. We're tempted. We're tempted to return to Egypt and Pharaoh. When we think about this in our own lives, right, what is Egypt? What is Pharaoh? It's anything that promises us security and identity apart from Jesus Christ. Anything that promises us security and identity apart from Jesus Christ. It could be your job. It could be the sports that you're involved in school. It could be your bank account, your retirement. It could be the house that you live in. Any of those things, all of which are not bad, they're good, but all of those can be Egypt or Pharaoh. We look to them for identity and security. So Pharaoh plans, and God laughs. But in the second half of this chapter, we turn our attention to Moses. Right? Moses, the deliverer, the one that we know, because we know the story of Exodus, we know where this is going to go. But I think it's important to see the way that Moses plans, Moses acts, and what happens. Here's the way I would put it. Moses plans, and God waits. Moses plans, God waits. Now, I think we see in this chapter a lot of positive characteristics of Moses. Okay, I think the first thing we see here that the text is clear about is that Moses identifies with God's people. Now, we don't get all the background details of how this comes about. How does Moses know that he's an Israelite? Which is where you get movies like the Ten Commandments that get to fill in all kinds of fun details. But it's clear from the text that Moses knows and that he identifies with the Israelite people who are in slavery. That's not a small thing. That's not a small thing. Recently, I was reading about Fayisa Lalesa. Fayisa Lalesa. Somebody who in today's world can't go home because he identified with the suffering of his people. Lalesa is part of the Oromo ethnicity within Ethiopia. He's also an Olympic marathoner. And so because of this, he had gained fame within his native Ethiopia, but was determined to use his fame as a platform to speak out on behalf of his people. Because according to a report from Human Rights Watch, since November 2015, Ethiopian troops have used excessive and lethal force against Oromo people, against people angered by marginalization and a government plan to annex traditional Oromo land. Hundreds of people have been killed, many of them children, and thousands have been injured, arrested, or simply gone missing. And so at the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio, as he was about to cross the finish line, Lalesa raised his arms, crossed his arms, and made fists, a traditional symbol of Oromo defiance. Now, his wife, who was in Ethiopia at the time, reported watching him, reported that the family and everybody gathered was there. They were cheering him on. This was the last little leg. And as soon as he made this gesture, which he did four times, the room went silent. Because they knew he had marked himself as a wanted man. They knew he could not come home because he identified with his people. He said afterwards, "I'm in exile." He now lives in Arizona. He says, "I'm in exile, not for myself first and foremost, but for my people. And my people are suffering. The day I will cry is when my people win justice and freedom. That day I cry nonstop out of joy." Now, thankfully, he has, since the Olympics, been able to be reunited with his wife and two small children. But his story is a reminder that identifying with those who are suffering, identifying with those who are oppressed, comes with a cost. And Moses knew that. Moses had to have known that if he is going to identify with God's people, this will in some way, shape, or form put him on a path that would cross Pharaoh. So he identifies with God's people. We also see, very interestingly, three different stories here that highlight, I think, Moses is driven by justice. Although you could say it's his kind of own form of justice that he's executing, he gets angry when he sees this slave being beaten by an Egyptian. He gets upset when he sees two Israelites quarreling over something. He gets upset when he sees these men driving away Reuel's daughters from the well. I was struck by this because I got to admit, I did watch part of the Ten Commandments not that long ago. And it's really interesting because Moses kind of sounds like a mid, 1900s person, striving for justice and human rights for all people. So I've always been like, well, this seems really out of context. But as I went back and looked at Exodus 2, I thought, there's actually something to this. Moses, he's on the lookout for things that are going wrong, and he seems ready to intervene, maybe too much so, to try to set things right. But Moses is driven by justice. Now, he will have to learn God's justice rather than his own human justice. But this, I think, is a characteristic that we will see come forth again and again in Moses' character. Now, here's probably the most frustrating of all from God's perspective. Moses has initiative. Moses takes things into his own hands. He sees something going wrong and he says, "I'm going to do something to fix this." Even if that is the initiative to murder, which it's pretty clear in the text, he premeditated, he calculated what this would be, and he tried to hide it. But Moses has initiative. He is taking things into his own hands to try to set right these three different situations that seem to be out of control. And I say this has got to be a little bit frustrating from God's perspective because, anybody remember what Moses' response is when God says, "Come and do this for me," when God calls Moses? He's like, "Wait a second, no, you don't mean me. Right? I'm not qualified, I'm not ready, I'm not competent, I'm not able. It's very interesting, is it? When we're the ones planning, when we're the ones setting the agenda, we're all about it. But how easy is it for us, when it's God who sets the agenda, to come up with all kinds of excuses about why we can't actually do this thing? Moses has initiative. When we get to the end of the chapter 2, I think what we see is this. The more Moses takes things into his own hands, the further he is, or at least the further he appears to be, from actually helping his people. Right? In some ways, we expect, or we kind of maybe think of the story of Moses as a rags-to-riches kind of story, right? Born in slavery, and now he's at the center of Pharaoh's household. He has power, money, and authority himself. But what you see in Exodus 2 is that as he takes things into his own hands to fix the situation, it seems that it spirals more and more out of control, that he moves from riches to rags. So at the end of this story, he's in Midian, and just in case you're not up on your ancient Near East geography, Egypt, that's where the people of Israel are. Midian, that's where Moses is. Egypt, Midian. Egypt, Midian. That's a ways. That's a ways. He is removed from his people. He is removed from his ability to help them. Even his identity is in some ways in question. Right? What do the women say after he delivers them from the shepherds at the well? This Egyptian did this. Who is Moses anyway? And so I think part of what this shows us is that we must come to the end of our own initiative and plans in order to see God's salvation. We must come to the end of our own initiative and plans in order to see God's salvation. Who is Moses? I'm a stranger in a strange land, an alien in a foreign land. Somebody who is, in some sense, disconnected from his family, disconnected from his people, even in some ways disconnected from God, right? As far as the text does not talk about Moses being in any kind of relationship with God or having any kind of real awareness of God at this point. So we have to come to the end of ourselves. We have to acknowledge, I don't know what I need, and I don't know how to get there. That even how I would define salvation or how I would understand God's deliverance has to be changed, has to be reframed by God. So Moses plans, Moses takes the initiative, and God waits for the wheels to kind of fall off. Let him run with that course, and when he's in the desert, far away from his people, struggling with his identity, now, in the last few verses of this chapter, we hear about the plan that matters. We hear about the plan that matters. And it is interesting to note that all throughout this chapter, up until verse 23, we don't get any mention of God. God is setting these things up. He's letting them run their course. But in verses 23 through 25, we hear that God does four things. God hears. God hears. Now, what does God hear? This is interesting. In verse 23, it says, "The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out." Notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say they cried out to God. So even for the Israelites in slavery, there's a sense of something's wrong. We don't like this. We want deliverance. But even for them, there seems to be a lack of awareness of who to cry out to. But they cried out, and their cry for help went up to God. God hears, and God is aware of his people's suffering. God remembers. Now, I want to be clear. When the text says God remembered his covenant, it's not as though God is sitting up in heaven saying, I forgot. I was busy. I had to run some errands for the day. I was doing some baking, right? Some stuff around the house and kind of just forgot about this. The idea here when it says God remembers his covenant is this sense that God is going to act in order to bring these promises to bear. The time has come. We know from other passages in Scripture, Genesis 12, Genesis 17, Genesis 15, when God is talking to Abraham, he tells Abraham, your descendants are going to be in slavery for hundreds of years until the time is right for deliverance. So even this suffering, even this slavery, is part of the plan. It's part of the plan. But God remembers, and it says God sees. God looks, God looked on the Israelites. And this seeing, again, expresses awareness. He knows their suffering. He knows their pain. And finally, the NIV says, was concerned. Another way to think about this is that God knows and cares. The word here, the Hebrew word, yada, has this idea of knowing, but it's not just an abstract intellectual knowing. It's a sense of knowing what someone is going through, of empathizing or sympathizing with them. And so God knows and cares. And we see that God will provide a deliverer. That there is a deliverer coming. And we'll see in the coming chapters how exactly this looks. But this morning, I want us to think about the plan that matters. The plan that matters. God says in Jeremiah 29:11, I know the plans I have for you. Now, this is a verse that often gets misquoted. I just want to say it again, making a point of emphasis. I know the plans I have for you. Not the plans you have for you. I know the plans I have for you. God is working out his redemptive purposes in his way, in his time. And what this means is that we have to trust. We have to trust that he is providing a deliverer. Not a deliverer in Exodus who is going to come directly out of Pharaoh's palace. Not a deliverer who's going to come with royal robes, but a deliverer who's going to come as a shepherd. A shepherd. I know the plans I have for you. See, before the foundation of the world, God the Father determined to send his Son to be the deliverer, the one who would go from riches to rags so we could go from rags to riches. The one who would give up the benefits and glory of royalty in order to identify with us, with his people, so that we, slaves to sin, could become children of the King. Who would be rejected by his own people, who would ask him, like the man in verse 14 asked Moses, who made you ruler and judge over us? Who would be rejected by his own people so that we could be accepted by the Father? Who would become a stranger in a strange land so that we could have an eternal home? So where are you at today? Are you fixing your eyes on Pharaoh? Are you looking for God in the big things, in earthly power? What are you trusting in? Have you come to the ends of your own plan? And maybe there's somebody here today who has never actually even made that first step of faith to say, I put my life in God's hands. Maybe that's where you're at. Maybe that's what God is calling you to do. Do you trust God's plan for salvation? And maybe there are others here today that I would just ask, have you come to the ends of your own plan for your everyday life? Day in and day out, is it about your plan or is it about God's plan? When your life doesn't go the way you think, when you try like Moses to exercise control and things spiral out of control, what do you do? Try harder? Work harder to control it all? I know the plans I have for you. For your deepest need, there is a deliverer. For your daily needs, there is a deliverer. Trust Him. Trust Him. Let's pray.